CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Supported and empowered by the students of SFU and listeners like you. For your community, by your community. You are CJSF.
Show, Jeff Thiessen will be giving us an update on Thrive. So what's the latest with Thrive?
Hi, Jim. Yeah, well, the latest is it's going to get in the mail, which was a bit of a problem for a publisher with the print publication and the Canada Post situation, but we're getting the mail will move. So that's good news for us, because we just released an issue, our fall issue, which exciting. We really brought some different topics to the forefront, like navigating pregnancy with an amputation. We did a piece on pickleball, which we haven't done before. That was fun. Osseointegration, where amputees have a metal rod, inserted into the sort of bone marrow cavity. It's a permanent connector to the prosthesis. So learned a lot about that, and some really motivational and inspiring profiles as well, especially around the sort of topic of resiliency and sort of changing the conversation about that. It's not so much, get up and dust off and return to, what you used to do. It's really about looking forward and what you want to do in the future, and how resiliency plays into that. So, we were proud of it. Good issue.
So, I'm curious, the topic of pregnancy for an amputee isn't something I've ever really heard discussed before. What are some of the key considerations that you folks covered and bring it to the forefront?
Well, I think the primary issue is the changing of volume of the residual limb. I mean, as amputees are, some call them stumps, as I do, residual limbs, they change shape depending on temperature, water retention, and that affects our fit. So as women naturally put on weight during pregnancy, that significantly affects the fit of their socket. So other means need to be considered in how they're going to get around until they can get back in their socket. Crutches, use of a wheelchair, whatever it may be. So that was kind of the biggest focus of that piece, managing that concern or issue that comes with pregnancy and limb loss.
To that end, have you ever done a story on how to discuss prosthetic child?
We have. We've done it from a parent's perspective, from a grandparent's perspective, because so many new amputees are seniors, circulatory problems, diabetes, and it impacts grandchildren quite significantly in some cases too. So we've kind of helped with some of the talking points and language and getting the conversation going with kids.
So what inspires you to look at sort of the underrepresented aspects of amputee life? I mean, it sounds like we're covering some ground that needs covering but hasn't necessarily given the attention it's due.
Yeah, the friends of mine, we have amputees who started families with lower limbs. They had told me until just recently there was really nothing as a resource for them. And, you know, that might be surprising to some of us that work in media and the World Wide Web, but that ground has just not been covered for them. So if we can help source other people's experiences and how they manage and share that with those that are having difficulty finding that kind of information, I think that's how Thrive is kind of serving its best purpose.
So what are the next steps?
Well, I think for us, Paralympics are around the corner, you might say, early 2026. So, our publication does not lean into elite performance, but there's definitely stories worth telling from our NIMLOS community. So we want to share some stories of Paralympians that will be competing as amputees. And I think an area that we need to focus more on that we'll look to in 2026 is diabetes. Prevention of the loss of a second limb. Managing diabetes after limb loss through, be it diet, exercise, health and wellness across the board. So those are some of the things we're going to be looking at in 2026.
It's funny you mentioned about the Paralympics. I always hear stories of the athletes themselves, very little about the accessible features of the venue. Someone coming in with an amputation, that would seem to be a big concern.
Yeah, I competed at 3 games, and those were a while ago, late 80s and early 90s. And, accessibility for a Paralympic Games, I would imagine, is first and foremost for villages and the cafeteria and, social areas. So I have not been in those venues or those villages and in many a year. I would imagine there's still some issues here or there, but I can't imagine that they wouldn't have a very focused lens on that.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you could stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure thing. Thanks, Ken.
Of course. In this segment of our show, Alan Smith, Carol Hawthorne, and Alex Nail will be telling us a little bit about IDS. So what can you tell me about IDS?
Hey guys, who wants to take that one?
Sounds like an ED question to me.
So yeah, Intellectual Disability Society, we're an agency that was set up 70 years ago, certainly when there was a move away from the institutionalization of individuals with intellectual disabilities, where they were just sort of shoved away in a corner, more into group homes and back into the community more, where they could foster and grow. And so we've really spent the last 70 years helping people to be the best they can. It's probably a good way to sum it up. We've been, various names and all sorts of things over the years, but it's still the same quality service, same good work, where we help prepare people to integrate more and more into society and to meet their personal goals. Well, that's sort of a quick rundown on who we are as a society.
So how do you go about reaching out to folks with intellectual disabilities to let them know that you are a source of support for them?
Yeah, our main focal point, a lot of people come to us through our local government funding agency, because a lot of them have to be referred to that. Depending on the type of service, we do take have a lot number of people who come to our programs who are privately referred. So to reach them, it's usually through word of mouth. We reach out to the local schools to certainly attract people at a younger age. Further along, we just rely on social media, our web page, and local contacts. We do advertise in the local newspaper just to generate a bit of awareness. Usually find word of mouth is still the best way for people to reach out to us and to know who we are and what we do. And we strive very hard to keep our reputation high in terms of the quality of work we do, so people are more willing to talk about us and do that, and over the years that seems to have worked very well. We are well thought of in what we do.
So, what are some of the most common services that are requested for those with intellectual disabilities?
That one I'm going to throw over to the team. Let them have a go.
You know, as far as you know, families coming in looking for services, it's typically community inclusion. Often, families, you know, their children finish school, move from ministry to CLBC, and are waiting for service, and are concerned that, you know, oftentimes there's not enough activity, there's not enough for their child to do, so they're reaching out for community inclusion programs. You know, CLBC refers into our program, so probably where we have the most referrals would be in our life skills programs, and that's where individuals either live with families or live on their own, but might need a little bit extra support to do grocery shopping or, you know, learn how to care for their apartment or those types of services. Followed next by respite. So we have children's respite where families get around 4 hours a week where they can have somebody come in and care for their child so they can have a break. And then we have our staffed homes. So those are always at capacity. We have 11 with up to 5 individuals in each of the homes where they have 24-hour staff support. So that's probably in order of how often we get people interested in the services.
So, do you ever encounter any myths or stereotypes concerning intellectual disabilities?
Most often, I would say, in the employment program. So, you know, we know statistically that people who have intellectual disabilities are, you know, really reliable employees, you know, eager to do their job well. We've had great success, but getting employers on board can be challenging. So, you know, dealing with myths about, I think people mistake mental health with intellectual disabilities. So, you know, being able to share all of the great things about the potential candidate and being able to go in and try positions, and employers are often pleasantly surprised with what great employees they are.
So, in your
time, we just get the confusion sometimes with disabilities, and this is something that came up to me recently. We're currently rebuilding one of our locations, and the inspectors were constantly, "Oh, it's got to meet these disability regulations," which of course we're living up to, but there was quite an emphasis to make sure that, you know, they felt that all our individuals were in wheelchairs or similar, and of course they're not. So it was interesting just seeing that side of it as well. But yeah, they were a little bit overboard on one aspect, which is not always true. So there's the intellectual disability aspect of it is our real focus, but we do have people who are across, unfortunately have disabilities across the board, but intellectual disabilities is the focal point for us.
So, in your time with the organization, is there any success moment or story you'd like to share?
What? Can you think of any? Alex, have you got
any? I can think of quite a few. So I predominantly manage the staff home, and I think for me, I was working with one individual who's got intellectual disability. He had never been on vacation. He did present some challenges, and staff were reluctant to take him a little bit further afield. So we just ensured that the individual was all part of the process with reference to research, where that individual wanted to go. We made sure that we had appropriate systems place, and that the staff who went with him knew him well, able to support him. So he went on vacation over to the island, had an absolutely fantastic time, and came back, and it kind of opened the doors for many more opportunities, so that individual now goes on holiday on a regular basis. So, you know, that also filtered through the rest of the house as well. So, because he was so successful, now more of the staff want to support this individual to go on vacation, because he tends to go far and wide. He's really spreading his wings. So, yeah, that's for me. It was just brilliant that he came back and he just had such a fantastic time.
Like to thank you all for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
And then I noticed this old guy, face like an old shoe, and he walked across the room. And there in the corner, I hadn't seen it before, was this jukebox. And he put in a coin. And he pressed three buttons.
Cowboys and Indies has been bringing you the best in British indie and alternative music for over 30 years on CJAM. Tune in every Saturday night from 9 p.m. until midnight as we bring you the best in British indie and alternative music right here on CJAM 99.1 FM, CJAM.ca, and Kochiko 285. We are redefining radio in Windsor and Detroit.
You see, the thing that makes sense of this crazy world is rock and roll.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Alex Nail, Alan Smith, and Carol Hawthorne told us a little bit about IDS, and Jeff Teason gave us an update on Thrive Magazine. In this segment of our show, Grant McKenzie will be telling us a little bit about Our Place. So in your work with Our Place and poverty relief, I'm guessing you encounter a lot of people with health concerns, things like mental health issues coming in?
Definitely. A lot of mental health issues. We also see some of the stats I was reading and saying that over 50% of the people on the street suffer from brain injury. And I actually think that those stats will be increasing because of the number of fentanyl overdoses that we're seeing. So brain injury is huge. And the mental illnesses that become a part of that are incredibly apparent on the street.
So can you give me a bit of an overview of the supports Our Place provides?
Sure. Our Place is kind of best known for its downtown community center, where we serve over 500 meals a year. The community center is a place where people can come in for a bit of respite. They can come in, they can get a hot shower, they can get a meal, a cup of coffee, and they can connect with paramedics. And we've found that a lot of people who are suffering on the streets have also faced trauma and obstacles in going to hospital. And so they'll tend not to go to the hospital. And so we bring, you know, volunteer doctors and nurses to Our Place, which seems to work really well because they already trust coming in. So a lot of time people with wounds, open wounds, will come in and they'll get treated. And some of the stuff the doctors and nurses see is horrific that they deal with right there. And then we also have 30 beds of housing at this downtown community center. But on top of that, we also house about 500 people in different areas. So we have night shelter, you know, for people that come in. At one location, we have sort of what we call transitional shelter. So that's where it's open. People don't have to leave in the morning. So they get like a cubicle with a bed and a place to store their stuff. There's access to showers, there's access to meals. So that's a little bit of a step up from night shelter. And then from there we have supportive housing, So temporary supportive housing, which is part of some of the hotels that we're taking over and we're managing. And so we have lots of people in there, and that's for people who've kind of moved out of shelter, a little bit more stable. But they're still, these are wet facilities, so people are still struggling in their addiction, struggling with their mental health, and we're trying to get them the supports. And then we have permanent housing in new purpose-built buildings that are for those people who have kind of graduated from that transitional housing.
So,
and then on top of that, we also run one of the only long-term therapeutic recovery communities in Canada, on the island here. We have a men's program that has 40 beds, and we have a women's program that has 20 beds, and those are 9-month to 2-year programs with about 70% success rate because of the length of the term. And those are just fantastic. I mean, that's the hope end of the spectrum.
So I'd imagine that the work you do, given the scale of it, you'd have to work in partnership with some other organizations to really make sure folks succeed in their transition.
Absolutely, yeah. We work closely with Island Health. We work with the correctional system, you know, for people coming out of jail that are wanting to get into recovery or continue the recovery journey that they've started in prison. We work very closely with the provincial government. We also work closely with organizations such as Peers, so that we have supervised consumption sites in each of these housing sites, so that people aren't using alone in the room, where there's a much higher risk of death. And we also work with other recovery groups in town, to encourage people and to get that message out about that recovery options are available.
So in your time doing this work, is there any success moment or story you'd like to share that stands out for you?
There's a lot. There's a lot of success moments. And I think success is different for everybody. You know, like just recently, it was actually just on Tuesday there, I saw Paul the Poet for the first time in quite a long time. I hadn't seen him in a while because he's housed now, so he doesn't come to the community centre as much. And Paul is he's a poet, what's the name, Paul the Poet. He used to come in and sell me his poems for $2, and a little staple pieces of paper with his poetry written on it. And he was an alcoholic. That was his drug of choice, was alcohol. And just seeing him the other day there, and my first thought was, A, he's looking very healthy, and B, it's so good to see that he's still alive. You know, and for Paul, success is not needing to come to the drop-in center every day, just coming in for some special meals. We were having a big turkey Thanksgiving meal, which is why he was in. Coming in for those special meals, reconnecting. And it was lovely just to see that moment of interaction, that moment of friendship. You know, came up, gave me a fist bump, and we were having a chat. And that success on a small level, because he's gone from surviving to thriving, you know. And then other success is bigger than that. There are people who, especially they've gone through our neuros therapy recovery community, who are doing extremely well, who have, you know, they're working now, reconnected with their family, they're staying in their sobriety, their health has changed dramatically. You know, we've found a lot of times when we bring people in, especially to something like neuros, is that we have to retake their photo after 30 days or 90 days because their physicality has changed so much. Because they're getting a good night's sleep. They're not sleeping with one eye open, trying to hope that they don't get attacked or have their belongings stolen. And they're eating properly, and they're getting regular health checkups, and they're being put on the appropriate medications that's been, prescribed to them by a doctor. And those are So I would call those ones high-end success stories, but there's also a lot of minor stories. So someone getting a mat for the night where the previous night they spent the night on the sidewalk, you know? So success is measured in a lot of different ways.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
Friends, I can't help but be moved by the story of the poet. Fact is, the issues of poverty and disability go arm in arm, especially in this day and age. A person with a disability can sometimes struggle with things like basic medical care, legal recourse should something go wrong in a workplace. These are very difficult issues for any of us to surmount. The fact is, life with a disability can compound some of these matters. While it is true that supports and funding systems do exist, they don't always take into consideration the individual needs of someone with a disability. I mean, it's very different to need an accessible vehicle to get from point A to point B than it is to require, say, a gluten-free diet with something like celiac. Fact is, disability is not a one-size-fits-all proposition. But giving them the opportunity to get out of poverty, to break that cycle, and not just to live, but to thrive, is not only the right of the individual, it's the obligation of society. You can't put a price tag on the value of someone's life. I find it ironic, my friends, those in a position to solve many of the world's problems financially instead choose simply to create more problems by hoarding resources they think they're entitled to, rather than using them for the benefit of those who could make a difference in society, with new innovation, new community sense, new hope. I mean, it's up to each individual with a disability to take a step forward, to make their voice count. No one should ever be left in the dust simply because they can't afford what it takes to survive. Fact is, each of us has unknown potential if given the right tools, the right timing, the right moment. We can achieve what we never thought we could and break the expectations, the paradigms of society. Things are only impossible until they're not. People with disabilities prove that every day by creating something new and wonderful to the substance of our community. And honestly, who are we to say that just because they hit financial hard times or the skids, that they're not worth considering, they're not worth being included? Getting them out of poverty, working together, doesn't just better their lives, it can help stimulate the economy. For a person with a disability, will always shop where they're comfortable, will always go where they feel welcome. And yes, having money means they would want to spend it. They would want to patronize businesses. They would want to add to the substance of the community. So, cutting off the resources of the disability community is only doing ourselves a disservice. In fairness, however, the disability community is not the only marginalized group out there, and everyone wants equal treatment. Everyone wants to be taken into consideration. And it is hard for one group or another to get their agenda pushed through. It is hard to divide resources fairly. But I maintain, just because something's hard doesn't mean it's not worth doing. We can always find a way, a balance, so those with disabilities, those of different ethnic backgrounds, sexual orientation, gender identity, what have you, there's something out there in terms of representation for all. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.